discussions. I kind of look at my role as somewhat of a Raul Rivera, Oprah Winfrey, Phil Donahue, only with without the looks or the paycheck. Again, on behalf of the commander and staff of the National Air Intelligence Center, I'd like to welcome you to our Blue Book panel discussions. We are indeed honored to have you folks here today. Our distinguished civilian and military alumni with our reunion activities, and especially in light of this 25th anniversary, Blue Book anniversary. Is it the 25th anniversary of the closing of Blue Book or the opening of the
closing?
Okay. What we'd like to do is we have what we think is a pretty good show for you today. But in any event, our purpose in bringing together our Blue Book panel discussions is twofold. First, with the anniversary of Project Blue Book and the current media blitz of all the UFO-related news stories, we felt appropriate to, as I like to say, as Paul Harvey says, get the rest of the story from the real experts in the science and technology areas. Unfortunately, most of us may have been weaned on contemporary press media, which leans toward the existence of extraterrestrial activity. We want to use our time today to exchange stories about your work on the project and talk about any other work experiences which articulate the Intelligence Center's contributions to our national security. Our second purpose is to, well, how can we say, pass on down an oral history of each of your professional experiences to some of our less seasoned military and civilian professionals who now carry the charge for the National Air Intelligence Center. I encourage each of you to offer anecdotes of your Blue Book experiences. Our audience and staff are all very friendly and eager to listen to your story. It's important to note, as far as I know, that all Project Blue Book subjects aren't classified anymore, but I want you to be aware there may be some exceptions if we get into details of intelligence collection or analysis discussions which reveal modern-day activities or capabilities at the Air Intelligence Center. I'd like to point out again, we have no media present today or other folks who will question your point of views or comments or anecdotes. We are, however, as you can see, taping this event for official historical purposes. What we'd like to do now, we've prepared a little video to try to set the stage for our discussions, which some of you may find humorous or thought-provoking, depending on your views. The video lasts about 15 minutes. Great, as a matter of fact, courage that you've all exhibited in the face of such dangerous aliens. I think you folks are definitely out of recognize your contributions to national security. I'm curious, though, what we try to present here, obviously, is the whole cut of the pie of the UFO myth dilemma, if you will, all the way from the media perpetuating the event through the so-called experts who have their anecdotes and stories, and then we tried to obviously bring levity in it with, as you all, most of you recognize, Colonel Quinn Ellis' response. Nonetheless, the myth keeps getting perpetuated. There's just a wealth of anecdotal evidence, but yet little physical evidence. But we have the great faithful masses who keep moving forward and surging forward, moving the UFO myth on down the street. Well, again, what I want to reiterate is we have a wonderful opportunity here today with our logical and clear-thinking scientific and technical experts that we have in the audience today. What we'd like to do is bring forward a panel of folks who, because of their experience with Project Blue Book and general varied experiences in the scientific and technical fields, they volunteer to serve as our discussion panel experts, if you will. Now that said, I'm going to rely on our folks who are going to be up front in front of the stage, but I'm also turning to the audience to add your stories and anecdotes and help answer questions or raise questions regarding this entire subject. And with the help of our historical films here and our good Lieutenant McAndrew, who just did the Roswell incident investigation, hopefully we can possibly lay a some of these myths and carry forward a clear thinking logic. I caution you that if we don't do this now, then we doom our future youth and science community to rely more or less on the popular press to get their information about Project Blue Book, because this will all be buried away in historical class. So again, I'd like to encourage you to take this opportunity to speak your mind and help facilitate our discussions. And if you don't, then we'll just go to lunch early. What I'd like to do is welcome our panel members. Again, what I hope is that a somewhat sterile, organized forum turns into more of what I'd like to say is an informal coffee class. I encourage you to speak your mind and proceed on. If I may ask, starting with Lucy, if you'd introduce yourself and maybe tell the audience and us exactly some of the things you've done.
I am Lucy Lacroix. That's how I am. Starting with this outfit in January the 3rd of 1946. Periodically. The colonel signed some was not for the book yet.
Grudge and Time.
Thank you very much. Well, when he gets to be 80, somebody will be around to help him.
Miles Gold, who was acting chief of analysis, just came in, and a few fragments of hardware that were collected. People picked up things that they said fell off of UFOs, or some of them actually were the models that were used in the spurious photography of the UFOs. That situation room was probably 8 feet wide and 10 feet long, with a door on it that had limited access that only a few people got into. Well, I thought I remembered George Gregory in there tacking up some of the early stuff when Colonel Gold took me in and showed me the room. This year when I talked to George and asked him about it, he said he didn't remember that he was involved at that time, but he certainly does remember later. George was I'd like to say a few words about him. He was got out of World War II, a captain. He'd been in the T-38 group snoop outfit of Elliott Roosevelt's reconnaissance in the battlefield, and was somewhat of had a World War career, a World War II career. He worked here as a civilian, then he was recalled during Korea, stayed in the military, went to Vietnam, concluded 110 missions in Vietnam. He's been decorated frequently for efforts in the intelligence field as well as in the reconnaissance in Vietnam. I tried desperately to get George to come, and he's the person who should be sitting here. But unfortunately, he was scheduled to have a hip replacement, rework, an overhaul, if you will, right this day. So he could not be here. But George sent me a box. I wanted to show you the box. Really a surprise. A beautifully arranged box. And in it, when I open it, I've got a 150-page summary of the whole UFO program. George has the implementing directives of the Project Blue Book all the way through. He picked up organization charts, some of the reports that came in that you saw in the movie, which was extraordinarily good. And then, of course, the final closure of the project. This is George's lifetime interest in the UFO effort. And he has, I think, created an outstanding document. I would like to make it available here for any of you seriously interested in what went on. They are all in plastic jackets, so some of these are irreplaceable documents, but you can come up and look them over. I am going to leave them here for a view. It was our intention, I talked to Bruce Ashcroft, that we would pass this on down to the Air University to be in the UFO file. Well, we found out the Air University has sent their whole UFO file to the National Archives. So it is now our intention to pass this on to the National Archives. Greg has deeded them over to me with a legal document. So I have the responsibility collect the collection highlights of information that we wanted, and he put them together in what became Air Force manual, and he has documented all this and has a record of the whole affair for which he was decorated. He also points out that the center at that time had tried two contracts. And in those days, we spent big money, $50,000, and the contracts failed to do the job, and Greg did them. And he did an outstanding job. And then third and lastly, Greg put together a military sketch of his own career. And I think this too is a astonishingly good document of a guy that went to the trouble to document his own career in a real fine heritage to his children. And all the children do have copies of it. But Greg has articles here on himself and publications, decorations, and so forth. Some of you that knew him well would probably like to browse in there. I also contacted Colonel Nate Rosengarten, who was recalled for active duty to then Attic in 1951. And he was head of, the aircraft division analysis, or aircraft branch of the analysis division. And he said he was the one who appointed Captain Ruppel to the requirements for an officer to be the first Blue Book officer. He said he appointed Ruppel because Ruppel was a real fine officer, did whatever he was asked to do in a real good fashion, and knew he would do a good job. Tried to get Rosie to be here to sit on the panel because he actually went out on a couple of the reviews of officers who had seen flying objects, in particular two pilots in the Fort Monmouth area. Saw a flying object while they were flying a training mission. And at the same time that they reported these objects close to them, the Fort Monmouth is an Army electronic center, and the radar operators at Fort Monmouth were tracking the UFOs at that time to corroborate the information. Well, when Rosie sat in on the review with these officers, and then later, I guess, the analysis proved that the whole thing was, as many of them, tracking a weather balloon. It had automatic altitude compensation features in it. As the temperature changed, the balloon changed altitude, and all the evidence seen by the pilots and by the radar were corroborated with the behavior of the balloon. So I think there were a lot of instances like that. Colonel Rosengarten wanted me to be sure and tell you that he thought that the more sightings were reported, fostered even more new ones to come in. Every time you had a good headline item, well, then you'd have a bunch of new ones reported shortly after. Now, my last association with the project was that I sat in on several briefings by a major friend and Lieutenant Colonel Quintanilla. It was usually with Dr. Hynek present. He was our contract consultant on the UFO. He was a professor of astronomy. So we would sit in staff meeting and listen to this, the status and the progress and what they were about to do. And it was almost always a unanimous opinion of the staff. Herman here, I remember real well. Everybody coming because of health problems. And I think the long-range projection that Major Laverty spoke of, when Bruce spoke of, into the future, what we're going to do next year and the year after, it occurs to me it won't be too many years before they're going to have a different group of people here to listen to it. But nonetheless, Homer said he was given the job one day going up to the Pentagon, and I guess somebody like Weinbrenner said, Homer, when you're up there, go rap it on the doors from the Pentagon till you find somebody that will get us off this Bluebrook project. So Homer went to several staff offices. He said, everybody agreed, let's get out of it. But he said nobody would take the responsibility of implementing this till they finally found some office, albeit PR office for chief of staff or whatever. So the Air Force kind of got out of the business, and it became a national science project from there on. Last year, when Colonel Quentin Ella came up, Bruce and I met with Carl Day, the local TV producer, and talked a little bit about what we could, what we knew and our experience associated with this project. And then I think within a month, Carl Day had Colonel Quentin Ella on local TV. And I believe what the picture you saw here of Quentin Ella's comments, less his expletive, but on what he thought of the project, may have come out of that interview. Quint was not in particularly good health. He had a heart attack while he was here. He unfortunately didn't feel strong enough to come up and be on the panel. Well, that pretty well sums up what I know about it. And again, my apologies for being sitting here with the UFO expert. I picked up a book just a day ago, UFO Encounters. And it's a real classy book. There's a lot of pictures in it. But on page 32 of the book, I think you can at least see the size of the picture that's dedicated to it. We have General Roger Ramey, who was then the commanding general of the 509th, the only U.S. Atomic Energy Delivery Outfit in the Air Force then, speaking to General John Samford, who is the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence. And we have Captain Ed Rubelt looking over, seeing what Samford is telling Ramey. And then we have the illustrious Roy James sitting to my left looking over, and Colonel Bauer in the background here, who was then Chief of the Analysis Division, and Dr. Griffin, who was in our basic science organization. They had all gone up to the Pentagon to discuss what Roy is going to tell you about. But I just want to tell you that we've got at least one very prominent national figure in publication in our group here. That's about all I have to say. I'd be glad to respond to any questions. Bye now.
I'm facing a difficult dilemma. Was there a question?
Yeah, I had one over here.
Please.
And a quick one about the material. I'm a member of the Air Force Museum Foundation. I'm curious why that isn't a candidate.
I have contact with them, and they would like to see it.
If you get it in the archives, it disappeared. If you put it over here, it might even be available.
I'll tell you more about that.
Mr. Billy, no one has mentioned the little green men, and anyone that knows that I've worked in space are always asking me about it. So I will tell you all about the little green men.
so bold as to try to get some more introductions, and then hopefully we can sneak in a few of these questions that I think would be of value to the historical record. If I might, Roy, would you like to say a few words about where you worked, and then maybe we can get into your background as part of the discussion?
I worked in the electronics division for many years. Getting back to the UFO problem, the most famous UFOs as detected by radar were those that occurred over Washington, D.C. in the hot summer of 1952. They reached the point where FTD or ATIC was called on to send people down to help solve General Sam's problem. When we got there, of course, the UFOs were gone. They were no longer on the radar scope. And somebody had told the press to take any scope photos, so there was nothing to be analyzed. But I had had 2.5 years' experience with the radar that was used at the airport there, National Airport. And this press conference lasted an hour and 20 minutes. And in that hour and 20 minutes, I answered or made statements 45 times. In fact, I felt like I was on the hot seat. I kept looking at General Sanford to see if he thought I was taking over. A couple of times he said, if I may relieve Captain James, and he'd say something, and it would come right back to me on radar detection. When this happened, the intelligence department in Washington sent two officers over to see the scopes. And they reported back to General Sanford that yes, there were solid UFOs, and that they had surrounded Washington, D.C. Of course, all heck broke loose. My experience with this type of radar, I was familiar with the weather effects that cause detection of ground targets that are not normally seen. And I postulated over and over that was what was going on. And 1 hour into the press conference, General Sanford more or less agreed to that as the answer to the UFOs as they were seen by temperature inversion effects on radar. I have a piece of a book here by Dr. Donald Menzel. He wrote a book on the world of flying saucers. And in this report, he reports that by dawn, this fantastic war of the angels, radar signals, had ended and the postmortems had begun. One radar expert who kept his head in spite of the hysteria is Captain Roy James of ATIC, who immediately recognized the targets as caused by weather. I did that without ever seeing the targets on the scope. Today, this is the answer.
Two studies. assigned a project officer, and I was assigned to assist him. And we carried this through the, since we didn't have any money, we depended upon the OSI to run our investigations. We didn't have any money for travel expenses or anything. So, we depended on the OSI to give us the information. The first thing we had to do was take a roadmap, where we wanted to go and how we were going to get there. To this end, we started to draw essential elements of information, which was an outline of the information we needed to try and identify these flying, well, what they call them, unidentified aerial phenomena. So to do that, we come up with a list of things we needed to know, and then the other thing was that we had to task different people to do that. Because we didn't have the wherewithal of the knowledge, because most of it was celestial in nature. And at that time, we brought in a contractor, which was Heining, Professor Heining from Ohio State. And we were lucky to get some money to do that. And the first flying saucer report was by a fellow by the name of Arnold, Kenneth Arnold, out in Boise, Idaho. He was a civilian pilot, and in describing what he saw, he described it as kind of like a saucer. So that became the flying saucer. That's where the word flying saucer started. And after that report, they started to come in such numbers, and they actually increased quite a bit after the publicity. That, you know how the news media does, they blew it up. And from then on, we started to get quite a few, and people started to ask questions. And one of the guys that was asking questions was the Saturday Evening Post, and we gave an interview to Sidney Shillette, and Sidney Shillette wrote an article on it, and then we really did get a lot of reports in, and most of them we couldn't identify because there wasn't enough information. Some of them came in from overseas. We started studying this, and we found out there'd been reports of unidentified flying objects way back to biblical times, class in Fiery Wheel was one of them. Ezekiel saw that. And as we went on, we had to task other outfits. I think we asked Project Rand to help us. We asked Patel to help us. We asked the Weather Bureau to help us. And we even sent stuff out to Sandia, which at that time was a research missile base, I think. And we kept getting reports and getting reports. And finally, since we weren't getting any answers to a lot of these questions that were raised by particularly the media, we decided to close down the report, close down the project. In which we did in, I think it was in August, I think, of 48. And this is a copy of our report. And our report was basically, if you got a minute here, we'll, there is no evidence that objects reported upon are the result of an advanced scientific foreign development, and therefore they constitute no direct threat to the national security. went ahead and put it in there, and naturally we put a guard on it. And as usually happens, everybody gets interested in what's happening when there's a guard on it. So I think one of our wagons told them, oh, that's a bunch of little red men, or little blue men, that we picked up and shot down across it. And I think that might just be the rage.
Space and so forth. thrown on Earth. I mean, we disproved it completely. But as far as he was concerned, you folks landed in his backyard, you're never going to disprove it. So that's the kind of problems that you face when you're doing investigations. Now, as Vince just pointed out, UFOs are a big money item. Hynek, as long as he was with us, all the reports followed through me, so I knew exactly what he said, and I swear nothing was ever found of substance. Now, when we closed the project down, Hynek went on TV, he wrote books, he became a big talk guest, made all kinds of money. Now there is something, because he's making money out of it. The whole time he was with us, nothing. I swear, nothing. And as soon as he went, I got out of being a consultant for us, suddenly now there is all kinds of substance to the UFO subject, and he made all kinds of money. That's the kind of problems that you're facing in the UFO program.
Aviation Week and Space Technology, and they've uncovered through video, slow motion video, some kind of occurrence, meteorological occurrence, where there's these red sparkles and blasts of reddish light that occur over thunderstorms that they've never really captured before. So this meteorological phenomena, I think, hasn't given credit in the popular press. What I'd like to do is, we have our last panel member here. I'd like to describe some of his instances. Maybe we can take one or two questions from the audience. But I'd like to have Lieutenant Jim McAndrew describe some of his activities. I understand what you say. I want to go ahead and press on, because we're right at our time here. It's most unfortunate. But I think what Jim McAndrew has to say, you'll find quite interesting and provide
committee, the DOD committee, and now I hear we have another committee, and we continue
put things to bed, but